suggested that I should talk not about the Armageddon, but about the Last Judgment. First of all, we must say there are many Last Judgments because we live in the travelling now, and at each moment it's the last up to that moment. But before we examine the Last Judgment, we will examine what it means to judge. We'll take the word itself, break it down into its prime phonetic, and then define it. Can you keep it in your mind, or would you like me to try to operate in this? Is it possible to remember?
Yes.
Must be, because I guess a reply that was irrelevant. So the question must have been remembered. J, affirmation. Now, J and Y and I are represented by the same letter in Hebrew, and it just depends how you stress it, whether it becomes I, Y, or J. If it were merely I, it would mean a point, just a location in space. If you turn it into a Y, it means ascent to that point. And if you turn it into a J, that means to stress or affirm the ascended to point. So J means affirmation of that which is offered. And the next letter, U, means drive power, power to drive. So JU means an affirmative driving power. I don't have to write that down, do I? I can remember it. If I couldn't remember it, I'd write it down. So I'd know what it is. I was in danger of forgetting. The letter D means a door and a division. A division, divisiveness, separativity. So JU, affirmative drive power, plus D, division. The affirmative driving power is going to divide sheep from goats, haves from have-nots, hard from soft, beautiful and ugly. They're going to be divided. The G means consolidation or earth. So it means to affirm a divisive power. The divisive power is going to cut the consolidated, symbolized by the earth, into pieces. It's going to find out exactly what constitutes this solid globe, this mass of matter. So division is an analytic process. The E at the end means trine life, triple life, threefold life, a life of force, form, function. So judge means an affirmation, power, dividing or analyzing a consolidated situation, searching for a triple aspected life, a life of thought, of feeling and will, a life of force, form and function. That's the judge. The men part following it means to count and to evaluate, and the T at the end means to nail, fixate, crucify. So the judgment finally means the crucifixion and an evaluation of the triple life, consolidated, divided or analyzed by an affirmative driving power. Now let's remember that for judgment, and then we'll examine the nature of last judgment. Last says, join action to self-fixation, L-A-S-T. The last is when you bind yourself to a self-situation in which you are prepared to pin yourself, to nail yourself on your own activities. That's last. So the last judgment is that condition in which you're being put to self when, by affirmative power, it divides or analyzes its own substantiality in its triple aspect of force, form, function, or will, idea, and activity. And to count it, to evaluate it, and then to nail oneself on that so that it's permanently fixated. Now, a lot of people have been very frightened by last judgment propaganda in sermons and religious and philosophic speeches. The first last judgment we will consider is the one that happens to a man who, not consciously going down the road, muttering things to himself, judging the world, judging his actions, judging the actions of the people he knows, and he's suddenly hit by a car and instantly killed right in the middle of his last judgment. And that can happen to anybody. It's happened to a few people I know. A woman I know, having made a statement of an attitude towards husband, human society, the world at large, got in the car, got drunk and drove carelessly and killed herself. In the middle of her last judgment, she had fixated herself so that dying at that moment, she knew what she was thinking and feeling and willing in that moment. What her condition was, we haven't had word yet. But we do know that the judgment that you judge of yourself, each moment could be the last. If death suddenly comes, if in the middle of your condemnation or assessment of something, you are suddenly killed unexpectedly, that's your last judgment, and you're stuck with it at the point of death. Whether after death you are able to re-evaluate it or not is a very difficult problem. We do know that every night when we go to sleep, we go through a kind of death process. We lose our individuality in deep, dreamless sleep, and our last judgment before falling into deep, dreamless sleep conditions the processes that go on in the unconscious mind. And you may wake up in the morning or in the middle of the night with a mood that was determined by your last judgment before you fell asleep. And that's why it's quite a good thing to put yourself in a good mood before going to sleep. You all know the proverb, let not the sun go down on your wrath. Don't go to bed in a furious temper. If you do and fall asleep in that condition, the whole chemistry of your body is poisoned by the activities of the mood of that anger. So that's one kind of last judgment of going to sleep every night, a little death, becoming unaware of individuality and having had a last assessment of oneself, friends, acquaintances and the world, and that continues through sleep until you are able to wake up and gather yourself together and reassess the statements you made in the morning. Every day a new sun, new every morning is the sun. That's the other half of the same problem. Now, apart from accidental death and the death you suffer every night by going to sleep, which is an amazing feat of courage, you may have another death. An individual may actually prepare, rehearse and write down his assessment of himself, his friends, acquaintances, people at large, the world, and say, I am going to practice so that when I come to die, I'm going to have a judgment already formulated that is good for me and for everyone I assess. That's a special kind where you consciously sit down and assess life and the world and make up your mind beforehand in what condition you are going to be at the moment of death. And you rehearse it so that finally when you come to die, you remember, and this can be done, and I know people who have done it, who have been able at the moment of death to gather themselves together, remember their assessment of self, others and the world, and then die in that assessment, in being a good one. Now there's also another one, that was an individual, the Last Judgment, consciously assessed. But there's another kind, a social judgment. This can happen when a group of people in society, the group may be small or large, but a group analyze their life together, their history brought up to date in a now, and then assess their behavior, their force, form, function, their will, their idea, their activity as a group. And they may decide it's been a very good group, or they may decide it's been a waste of time. That last judgment of the group is one in which all the individual members in discussion cooperate together to formulate this assessment. Now we'll say that for a small social group or a large one, but not the whole of humanity. Now another judgment is when the whole human race decides to judge, to assess itself. Is it worth it? I have recently heard people say, if that's the human race, I want no part of it. They've been listening to news, they heard a profound statement by a gentleman of royal blood saying precisely because he had no experience of it, he could give an unbiased judgment. It is possible to be disgusted with humanity as a whole and not be able to account for its behavior over the record of 6,000 years of its history. That would be a world assessment by human beings influence each other's opinions throughout the world. At the moment, we haven't got enough coordination of all the nations of the world to make that kind of world judgment. And then we have another judgment, which religious people call the judgment of God, where not the total human race, but the source power that created that race is assessing the value of having created it, the value of the created human race as a whole. And this also has a final phase, a last judgment. Was the human race worth it? At the time of Noah, God decided to wipe away all the wicked by a flood. His last judgment was they deserve drowning, except for a very small number, Noah and his family. And then the great flood, and millions of people drowned, and very, very few were saved. That was the judgment of God. And afterwards, when the flood had subsided and people began to operate again, then God said, that flood was a waste of time. It has not reformed them. I will no more flood me the earth. It's no good. We cannot cure the human race by destructive activities aimed against that body. And a Negro preacher once said, in my presence, and this was in Liverpool, when God flooded the earth, men did not reform. And he saw there was no evil that they would not shrink from. And he said, I will no more flood me the earth. Next time, the fire. Now, fire has always been the symbol of an energy that reduces all matter to heat and then to light and disperses it. So the statement, I will finally set fire, Jesus says the same thing, fire. I will bring fire. What do you, if it be already kindled? The fire is already operative in revolutions, in interstate wars. It will grow, it will get bigger and bigger, and finally there will be a terrific conflagration. And everything will be purged. The word P-U-R in purge means fire. Everything will be purified by burning it. Everything will be reduced to primary energy, and all the wicked forms will be burnt out. That's the last judgment of God. And that one has been used as a very, very frightening concept, especially in the West, for a long time. But there is another view of the world, in which last judgment signifies something different. In Hindu philosophy and in Oriental philosophies like Buddhism and derivatives, you have a situation where the universe is conceived to alternate between periods of expression and periods of latency or rest. In modern scientific parlance, you could say periods of expression are ectopic, they turn out, and periods in which they are latent are entropic, turned in. You can turn out into the world, assess everything you see, relate to it, go out, hit it, stroke it, kick it, smile at it, say nice words, horrid words. All those things are ectopic. There's an ectopic phase followed by an entropic phase, in which whatever you have done, then you meditate internally on that thing, and you arrive at an assessment in your entropic state. That's like the paralaya of Hinduism, a flat leveling out, manifestation ceases. Manifestation ceases, and there is a level of flat energy. That's a laya state, L-A-Y-A. It's laying down, but it's not doing nothing. What it is doing is contemplating all its actions and the fruits of those actions and deciding where it went wrong and where it might have modified. And then, after a period in this entropic state, it decides to start again, a period of manifestation, ectopic. It then sets off a new world on the basis of its last judgment from the old world. The old world is a world that was before the present world and implies there has been a holistic evaluation. When we say OLD, if we put H before the OL, drop the D, whole, it's a primitive word meaning the whole. We put the W in front of the H-O-L and add the E. Whole means oppositional power, a unity, and the binding of that unity in a triple manner. Again, think, feel, will. The totality. So at the end of a period of universal manifestation, there is a judgment of the meaning of all of that activity. And that is the last judgment for that cycle. There is no final judgment beyond which there is no more judgment. There is only a final judgment up to the end of a period of manifestation. It's exactly like when you go to sleep at night and you survey, if you're not too tired, the meaning of your daily activities on that day, possibly even of the week, but you evaluate it before you go to sleep. You judge it. That's your last judgment for that day. And when you're asleep, you go through a dream phase and then into a very deep dreamless phase, and in that phase, which is entirely entropic, you decide how to lead tomorrow's life, how to lead future life. You do that in a state of deep, dreamless sleep. It's like shuffling cards about by feeling instead of visual sensation. Which is the more comfortable? This oriental concept from India of an endless cycle of worlds in which there is manifestation, assessment, sleep, and in the sleep a rearrangement, preparation for another period of manifestation. In that way, you have an infinity of possibilities of reform. And that was the current belief before Christianity in the Middle East and in the Far East. Everybody believed that the universe wound in and wound out. It manifested and then withdrew. And you would have an infinity of possibilities of reformation. Now it was found that when people believed this, two things happened to them. One was they stopped making efforts to improve and said, I'll reform next time around, like St. Augustine. That was a very, very dangerous thing. And the other was they became terribly frightened about what was happening when they're deeply asleep and do not consciously, individually know what they are doing. How do they know individually whether the decision made in that deep dreamless sleep is going to be acceptable to them when they wake up? Now that's a very frightening thought too, isn't it? That you may go to sleep, go through the dream into a state that as an individual you know nothing about. But you're not doing nothing, you are rearranging your life so that when you wake up, certain things are going to be attracted to you. You can call that destiny or fate or karma. They're going to be attracted to you because you decided that they would be, and you decided in a state of individual unconsciousness so that you don't know what you've decided. You might have decided you've been so naughty it's time for you to lose your job and wake up. Or you've been so good that you deserve to be deprived of rewards to make quite sure that you did the good for the good and not for the reward. Now this kind of process goes on in all human minds every night. How do we feel about that? The last judgment we make is tremendously important. A Russian or American missile accidentally triggered, if you believe in accidents, which I don't, triggered, might suddenly kill all of us immediately. What are we doing? What is our assessment of our situation now? Is it such that we can afford to have that assessment at the moment of annihilation of our body and we be flung into a state like deep, dreamless sleep, where the last judgment we made before death is now operative without our individual awareness? How does that feel? Comfortable? When you might be making terrible decisions to lead yourself into terrible troubles. Now in the Lord's Prayer there's a very difficult little bit that is generally avoided by the, as Abel discovered, the word the clerisy, the members of the church teaching, come across a little difficult passage. The prayer he's been saying to God. It's a prayer to God. And yet he says, lead us not into temptation. As if God would lead creatures into temptation. It's a very worrying line. Have you thought about that line? You say to God, please God, thou ultimate good, thou all compassionate, don't get me in a mess. I think I'm good enough already not to need it. Isn't that a very difficult line? Have you thought about it? I heard a very good, yeah. Possibly we've got the Russian spy amongst us. Doing a net on it. the fact that we judge all the time in our waking life. We judge our own actions for efficiency, inefficiency, pleasure content, pain content, and we judge the activities of other people in the light of our personal principles. And we're doing this all the time, generally unconsciously. But we pay the price of those judgments. And every night when we go to sleep, the judgments we have made add up to a pattern. And that pattern determines our future. When we wake the next day, we will do things, feel, think, speak, because of our individually unconscious decision made in deep dreamless sleep. I think that's a very nerve-wracking thought, if you have nerves. If you had no nerves, you wouldn't. But unfortunately, living human beings and animal beings have nerves. They can sense through the nerves things that are being laid down by judgment. You know, judgment, like prophecy, precipitates events. Judge not, lest ye be judged. If you judge, you put your mind in a certain frame. And that frame of mind will determine your next attitude, your next activity, and the excuse for the activity of other people. The last judgment, the judgment of the last, L-A-S-T. We bind ourselves actively to self-crucifixion by the judgment we make. Now, really, can we afford? A young man said to me today, I want to be able to live my life always telling the truth. Always to tell the truth. And I said, do you know it? I hadn't thought whether he knew it or not, but he was determined to tell it. His self-assessment up to date had been, I want to tell the truth to everybody. So I gave him a few little test questions of situations in which he might say something and note the reaction of the people to what he said. Well, it's always a good reaction. Sadly, he shook his head. Sometimes when you tell the truth, people don't like it. Should you tell it? Supposing a person in a terminal illness doesn't understand their own degree of neurological balance, and they say to the doctor, tell me, am I now at death's door? And if the doctor says yes, they probably die there and then. Or if he says yes, they may say, what does he think he is, God? He knows when I'm going to die? And they get better out of sheer awkwardness. That does happen, you know. I've known many cases of it. I was told I was in a terminal state, and his arrogance annoyed me. You know what I did? I started doing the exercises which the nurses came around every morning to make me do, which previously I had refused to do, on principle. So from that moment I wiggled my toes. My circulation increased, my ankles became less congested. I thought that feels a bit better, I'll do it with my knees. So I wiggled my knees, my hips, my lower abdomen, and I began to feel better. Then I suddenly realized I could really annoy this doc by improving beyond expectation. And then, fortnight later, he gets out of bed and says to the doc, you've been practicing that under the bedclothes all night. I'm not telling you fabrications, I'm telling you things I actually know about. So your last judgment, if voiced to someone else, might provoke them into a reaction, which you might have to put up with. I know a fellow, He's got a grandmother. She's quite young. She's only 93 at the moment. And he said to her she wasn't looking very well. He was hoping she wasn't very well. She said, "You're not going to get what you're expecting. I'm going to outlive you, in principle." It's a battle of wills. When you make a judgment, you don't make it in a vacuum. You make it in the field of the universe. And the universal power reacts to your judgment. We're not alone. Now, most people, when identified with the empirical egoic self, finite, they believe erroneously that it is insulated, that they have information there, that they can make judgments and assess, and no one knows about it. It's not true. When you go into deep, dreamless sleep, do you know you exchange information with other deep, dreamless sleepers? And you're continuously through the universal field of sentient power, passing information to your enemies and misinformation to your supporters, so that you can really have a problem worth working on. So judgment itself is very dangerous, and the last judgment, the one you're caught with at death, is very, very dangerous. How do you know if you cannot go to sleep consciously and in the dream have perfect self-control? How many have that? How many, when they go into a dream, have perfect reflection and can dream what they will dream and control it? How many do that? Not many. And then going into dreamless sleep, where there's no consciousness of individuality at all, and in that deep dreamless sleep, there is a plot, not only of an individual, but of the totality of all individuals in the total universe. And they're all swapping information with each other, like a wonderful international espionage system, where everybody is a triple agent for everybody else. Who does? You? Why?
Well, seems more sensible.
Seems more sensible? I would have thought it was all sensible. What's more sensible about that?
Well, when we're awake, we're trying to keep secrets, aren't we?
And when you're asleep, you're giving them away.
Yes, we are, but we don't think we are.
When you're awake, don't you try to keep more secrets, knowing that when you go to sleep you'll give them away?
I haven't thought about it like
that. Well, when you start thinking about it. During the day, normally, for business reasons, secrets are kept. If you're in business and you have a rival, you don't tell your rival where you buy from and what price or your anticipated market. You keep a secret. That's business. You can't conduct a business, say they, without doing it. I think it's possible to do it. I think it's possible to tell all your rivals exactly what you're going to do and still live, but not in that business. What it means is you change your business. Instead of having a low-level business, you go up a higher one. Every time you give away all your information, they're so grateful, a message goes through the field, this fellow deserves promotion, and he goes up. This is called ascending the scala perfectionis. You're rising all the time in efficiency, and right at the top, at the level of pure spirit, you are in business, called God's business. Busy about my Father's business. Now, there's no business like show business at that level, because that's universal. And you have the absolute backing of the absolute, and therefore you must succeed at that level, because you have told the truth at lower levels, and as a result lost your business. But you haven't lost your intelligence. Your intelligence is always providing you with a better business, a cleaner business. A man might be working in a very naughty, horrible business at the very bottom of the social scale. And then he might think, I don't like this dirty business. I'm going to tell all my rivals how to put me out of business by telling them where I buy and where I sell. And so he's thrown out of business. He's put on to social security. And then, with the amount of money which he gets from that, which is equivalent to the money he was getting when he worked, he starts a new business. But this time, not in the sewer. This time he's a road sweeper. Each time he does this, he goes up and up and up and up. And right at the top there's a pure business called the business of pure spirit. You don't get paid any money for it. You don't need any money for it. Yes, and that's the state that's in your waking state you are trying to dodge.
Yes, well that's why I think that the other
state. Do you give up the waking state process of secrecy because you know the other one is better?
Well, you should do.
Oh, should.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, should, must, know.
Well, it's an idea to keep in mind, isn't it?
How about an idea on which to act? Well, as long as you have this little proviso, a good idea about which to think, you won't do it.
Why not?
Because you said it's a good idea to think about doing it.
No, to do it.
But the actual doing of it.
Pardon?
The actual doing of it.
Yes.
So you tell the truth.
That means you remember it all the time.
Do you tell it? Don't you?
To me, it feels as if it's like being off-centre.
Like being off-centre?
On-centre.
When you're on-centre, do you tell the truth?
Well, never.
I've never been on it.
But I should think you would.
What for? Could you tell it straight or in parable?
Well, you tell it in parable. If you haven't to tell it straight, you'd have to choose.
Well, how would you know whether to tell naked truth or parabolic truth?
Well, if you were on centre, you would. But we're not on centre, are we?
That's always a very individual thing. And in an individual instant, there is time travelling through now. And you are always now. But you choose now whether it's time to tell the truth and whether straight or parabolic. I know you choose, yeah. You can't not choose.
Well, not consciously, do
you? If you're not
quick enough.
If you're not conscious and you're not quick enough, it means you're not interested enough. Consciousness is a matter of interest.
Yeah.
Quickness is a matter of interest. So if you're interested enough, you'll be conscious and quick.
Yes,
and
you'll be on-centered.
Yes. If you're quick enough, conscious enough, you will be producing the correct response. Having said that, every individual has to say truthfully, internally, whether or not in a given now, an instant, there is that kind of quickness, that kind of clarity that knows what is to be said. Because there is convergence and consciousness and the will to do the universal true thing. It's called an ideal condition. How many people try to make that ideal condition in daily life? Or how many think maybe later when I've learned more and made myself more secure, then I will be able to afford to make this true statement.
Well, it must be true.
Why do you say that? Well, you could think about it if there were only one doing it. You needn't be a few. One would be enough, providing the one with the whole one. Right, somewhere, your soul, your sentience, your sentient power remembers wholeness and knows it's not in that state now. That's called the four. There's an awareness of the wholeness of all being, all life, all worlds. They're all the same. They're all the supreme one. You remember it, and that is called conscience. It niggles you when you do something you know to be inefficient or wrong. It doesn't let you be quiet, because you remember wholeness is the primary experience of all beings. Now, when you've made that statement, that's the last judgment. Can you go further than that? Is there another judgment beyond that? Either reality is related absolutely to all beings or not. Well, let me put it to you. Let me put it to you. Do you believe in the absolute interrelation of all beings and no interrelation possibilities at the top level? You can't insulate one thing from another because it's a continuum. So there's no possibility of keeping a secret. It's bound to leak somewhere. And do you believe that? Right, then you have to make a judgment. On that basis, do you judge whether you live your life as if that is true, or whether it's so unpleasant you will deny it and say, I do not believe that that communication occurs, and I believe that individuals are insulated and I can keep my secrets and never be found out?
No,
and then you made the judgment that you believe in the absolute interpenetration of all beings. Then you must feel very uncomfortable every time you don't act on that belief. So you get a conscience. Conscience means the totality of your knowledge. Now, do you like being uncomfortable?
No.
Why not?
If it, I could say yes, no, couldn't I? I could say no, I don't like the feeling, but yes, because it makes you then remember it all the more.
Right, now take sides. This is another judgment. You don't like the feeling, but you know that the feeling leads you to a higher level and that you will suffer painfully, physically, psychologically, spiritually, until you go to the higher level. And you make a judgment. The last judgment you make is this: as from now, here, tonight, in here, you will make a super effort to act always in this non-dualistic, non-pluralistic, non-insulating type of activity. Do you make that decision? If you can remember that, you are immediately perfected. Now, for how long can you remember it?
Well, I can remember it, but how long do I... Is it before I fall by the wayside again?
And why do you fall? I used to have jokes with you about this, when you used to trip up occasionally. Yeah, and you used to blame me.
Yeah, well,
you remember?
I blame you now.
Yes, you used to say it was because you were looking at me. But I observed that when you walked, you didn't walk with the feet on parallel lines. You always walked with one forward and the other behind. Like that. That's why you tripped up. And what was the psychological meaning of that?
Well,
You put your right foot forward, that's your will, and the idea goes behind it and catches it and you fall. You get a new idea, truth. You put your left foot forward and the will goes behind and you tip up. And that was because at a certain level of awareness, you knew very well if you walked parallel like that, you'd get there. What? That's right, you'd have missed a few lessons. Excellent suggestion.
And I wouldn't have had as much confusion,
probably.
Probably.
You'd have been like that horrible son that never went out. The brother of the prodigal that did go out. Mm-hmm. Who, because he never went out, had no experience. Mm-hmm. And when the prodigal came home, he complained. Mm-hmm. He had his share. Why? Well, it's to kill a passive calf for him. He'd been paid already. Mm-hmm. So all your sins and self-trippings are merely to give you compassion. Yeah? Now, can you make a judgment like this? If that's all I'm learning, compassion, I'll have it now. And then I won't need any further lessons, will I?
Often people conscious in this deep dream of sleep to bring the knowledge of it back to the rest of us.
Some.
Mm-hmm.
There is a level that's not egoic consciousness. It's called super consciousness or universal consciousness, and it knows everything that everybody is doing all the time. It never goes to sleep. You know, in the theology, you get this idea that God is eternally awake. The field of power. Sentient power is itself ever aware. It has no need to sleep. You know what sleep is for? Assimilating a lesson that you didn't assimilate when you were awake. People lead their lives daily and they don't take much notice of the lesson that is there, do they? They're too busy, aren't they? Maybe a man comes to the door, he likes to look at your garden or your house, he thinks this is a good one. Madam, I'm a Buddhist beggar. I'm so poor I can't even afford saffron robes. So I've come in an ordinary civilized suit, which I got from Oxfam. But really I'm a Buddhist beggar. Now do you say, is this a calm trick? Or do you give him something? Now you have to assess then and there, don't you? And if you don't, you say, oh, I can't be bothered, I'm very, very busy. As a matter of fact, I'm weeding in the garden at the moment. And I saw two slugs going towards my lettuces. So if you say, goodbye, and perhaps some other day, and you go and remove the snails that are about to eat the lettuces, and you pull up a few weeds, but you actually did not learn the lesson then and there. So when you go to sleep, you have to reassess it. And we're doing this all the time. We've no time to deal with the problem that is here with us. We're too busy fighting for what we want.
Are you saying in that case then, if one was able to assess the lesson during waking hours, sleep would be not necessary.
Now, we said before that the universe itself is put to sleep periodically, alternating with periods of manifestation. God lets the universe go to sleep for the sake of the people that are fed up with the lessons that have accumulated which they can't deal with. Throughout the day, how many times have we put under test and are too busy to deal with it? And they add up. And if we get a great pile of them, we can go to bed and sleep like a log. And we're terribly busy. But if we practice and solve every problem, then in sleep time we reduce the need to re-examine it. But that requires very sharp alertness during waking time.
It often happens that before you go to sleep, you get yourself together and say, right, tomorrow I'm going to be better and do this, that and the other, more efficiently, etc. Go to sleep and wake up and feel absolutely terrible that you can't do the same thing. Is it that the unconscious is there working against the ego, or...
Yes, remember what you said about the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation. He ordinarily, when you go to sleep at night, preceded by a reformation promise, is because you've been in trouble during the day. You're not trying to reform. You're trying to dodge trouble. And your high self says, you want to dodge that trouble? I'll give you another one.
But how does that then relate to Last Judgment? Because you're going to sleep feeling positive about what you're going to do the next day.
You said positive.
Yes.
That means you posited something that pleased you. But what you actually posited was, I will so behave tomorrow, I'll have no further trouble tomorrow. Trouble is what I don't want. So I posit no trouble. And I call that reformation.
So then what happens then if you die in that time when you've posited that?
Well,
as your last judgment, if actually you're dodging.
Well, you're still struggling in the dream and you haven't enough control, have you? That's why I would say in Oriental philosophies like Buddhism, if you die in a state of unresolved judgments,
yes. You
spend perhaps thousands of years dodging the judgment.
So what's the best way to go to sleep?
Well, the best way to go to sleep is not pray to be released from trouble. But just pray, and prayer means work, for enough light for your next step. You want light on the ground where your foot is, not over there. Most people like a very long shining light up there. Just one foot at a time. If you were a Hindu, Orthodox, when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you have to say to yourself is, I and the Absolute are none different. Yeah? Remind yourself you have a divine origin. You say, I am the Brahman. I am this infinitely extended power that made the universe. But I'm in the body. So I put my foot out of the bed like this. I put it on the ground. Right foot, please. That means the will. And when it touches the ground, I say, I will now adjust myself to the material fact. And then get out of bed. There's an immediate material fact. Like you're a married woman, yeah? Supposing like a friend of mine, a vicar in the Isle of Man, who went on a holiday and forgot he was married. He went to jail for that, you know? And when you put your right foot down, I would say, I have committed myself to earthly matters. I accept my committal. That's that J, affirm. You know, like your name, Joy, means J-O-Y, affirm, situation, assented to. If you assent, then affirm it. If you're not going to affirm it, don't assent. How does that feel?
No escape.
You can see how very useful that Lord's Prayer thing is. Lead us not into temptation, but we know you. High and mighty, you're fond of prodigals. But I've had enough. I've prodigaled enough. And he says, who are you to say what's enough? I like funny stories. Prodigality provides them. You're not funny enough yet.
So why do we say it? What,
you mean why did Christ tell you to say it?
I would expect that to read lead us into temptation, not lead us.
Oh no, lead us not. You see, Jesus is a super psychologist.
Yes,
you know,
but deliver us from evil.
You get a dictionary of or a, what do they call them, phone book, classified. Look how many psychiatrists.
Yes.
And look how many.
Pages,
yeah. Look how many Jewish names there are. You see? They're all good psychologists already. You know why? Because they had to spread out for 3,000 years, learning amongst foreigners. And when they finally get back, if you like to go to Jerusalem or some big city in Israel, and you go down a road and you see a little brass plate and it says so-and-so, PhD, psychiatrist, and you look at the next door, there's the same plate with a different name. And you look at the next, and it's the same plate with a different name. And you know, the man that makes those plates has a very good business. Because he has them all stamped out except the name, waiting for the next immigrant. See? And Jesus is Jewish. And funny enough, God's Jewish too. Because the name Yahweh is a Jewish name. And the word Jew is made of the first three letters of God's name. And the fourth letter refers to infinity. J-E-U, in English, J-E-W, yeah, means Yahweh. And the terminal letter, which is the Hey, which means life, is infinite.
And it's
a Jew. Now, if you know that, you're not surprised if he bends the advice a bit.
Oh, not a bit, no.
No. So he says, did you say why did he do it that way?
Yes, it does. It puzzles me.
Well, if you're not surprised, why are you puzzled?
Mm-hmm. If what?
If you're not surprised, why are you puzzled?
Good one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's a fellow who gives good advice. Supposing he said to you now, when you pray to God, pray like this. Oh God, lead me into temptation. And that's the first thing you do. Seduce somebody else's spouse. You're already biased towards certain activities.
Yes.
You have license.
Yes.
So you say, lead us not. And that reminds you, because you're almost falling asleep, there is temptation. So you go on guard. You know what happens when you go on guard? You get tired, and you forget, and you fall, because you're on guard. That's Jewish. Didn't God do it on Adam and Eve in the same way? There's a nice garden in the middle of the tree of life, and a tree of knowledge of good and evil. You can eat everything except that one. Do you know, if you hadn't mentioned, they'd never go around to that one. You've never seen it. And have you noticed that you get medieval paintings of Adam and Eve in the garden before the fall, they've got no navels. Have you noticed?
No.
Oh, well, look. If it's before the fall, they haven't got a navel. Because they haven't started extroverting their love life. Mm-hmm. And the word navel means snake veil. Mm-hmm. Something to hide. Did God put the snake in the garden?
Got it.
Did he hold himself responsible for the presence of the snake?
Yes.
Which is a tempting. Well, then whose fault was it if they fell? Not God's. Because he didn't fall.
Can we not say both, because they are still God?
No.
No.
God, as God, does not make mistakes.
No.
He
God
is,
as man makes mistakes.
God as man makes mistakes by identifying with the finite condition of man.
Yes.
But that's not God.
No. No.
Even the Bishop of Durham. Yes, he knows that God is being the Bishop of Durham.
Yes.
In the place where the Bishop of Durham is.
Yes.
God made a deliberate mistake.
You can't. Nobody can make a deliberate mistake. They could do a wrong act deliberately, but it would not be a mistake. A mistake, by definition, is an error of judgment. You can't do it deliberately. Now, how important is this judgment? The last one we make, either before we accidentally get killed, for those who believe in accidents, or the one we formulate. It's a rather frightening thing, this question of the last judgment. I think I will write a note about it and put it up in the kitchen, and I read it every day. Birds in their little nests agree. I put it over the sink, and I read it every day. Do you? Or because it's there, do you not read it?
Because it's there, you don't.
You don't need to, do it's there in case you want to. And it says the serpent in the Garden of Eden was the most subtle of all the beasts. It's smarter than anybody. That's because it is the personification of pure sensuality. There was nothing finer in sensitivity than sensuousness. Only the intellect blunts the edge of it. There have been estimates about its relative speed. There have been experiments electrically with instruments about it. And some have come up with a statement that the sensuous judgment is 30,000 times quicker than an intellectual assessment.
The angels went off dark when the serpent was going to come in, when the devil was changing into a serpent. And they put lesser angels on that wouldn't recognize him as a serpent. Who did that? I don't know. Well, that's what Milton says. Michael and Raphael and the other archangels taken off.
Mm-hmm. Lesser angels
that wouldn't recognize
him. Well, who had the authority to put interior angels on the job?
Oh, God, I
God.
So, it was a trick he did then.
Another trick, even before Adam and Eve. You get that in the Quran, where it says very clearly that when man was made, God said to all the angels, bow down and worship this creature that I have made. And they all bowed down except one, Iblis. Satan, and raised the problem, why didn't he bow down? God is omnipotent, could have made him bow down. And the answer is God made him not bow down, so that Adam would not be conceited. If all the angels bowed down without an exception, Adam would have thought he was a super creature. So you must have a dissenter, even only one, to make rude gestures to you in your perfection. Otherwise you're in danger of total absorption in egotistic self-imagery.
Where does that come in, the angel bowing down to man?
In the Quran.
In the Quran.
Mm-hmm. There's a very, very nice description of that. You see, because man has no weapons like tigers, no long talons, no big teeth, no horns. He's very weak, the most vulnerable. Therefore, he has to be given intelligence, how to use instruments without growing them. If you want to pinch, make a pair of pincers. When not in use, put them in the tool drawer. If you want to fly, make an aeroplane. When not in use, put it in the hangar. You don't want to go shopping with wings. They knock things off the shelf. I heard about, did any of you see that wonderful blues program last night running until 1:30? Did any of you see it?
Yeah.
Do you remember a lovely song? It was my favorite of the evening. You know, blues is all about misery, personal sufferings. And this fellow sang a marvelous song. I'm going to blue so much. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'll go shopping. I'm going to die. I'll go shopping. I haven't made my mind up yet. That's so human, you know.
But what's he going shopping for?
You know, I knew a fellow that went to drown himself in the bath. Really? He was so depressed, he went in the bath and he filled it right up and it was going out of the drain hole at the top. So he got some plastic and munged it up until it was overflowing. And then he got in it with two bricks.
Oh.
No, I'm joking. And he held the bricks on his face and lay underneath the water. And then his brain began to work. It was very difficult, and he was thinking this, which he confessed to me afterwards. Is the water flowing fast enough over the edge of the bath to go under the door and down the passage and let the wife know? And he wasn't sure, and he had to get up. And when he got up, he said, to use it, I've been gone. So he took out the plasticine so she wouldn't know. And he let the water out, and he dried all the bathroom floor in case she shouted for his carelessness. Now, isn't that human? So isn't our judgment stuff wonderfully interesting? Thrilling stuff, really. Will it alert us? I said the other day, was it Friday, Zita?
Yes.
And write this thing out for me. Which she did, she's been doing calligraphy and she's very good at it now. Apart from her other talents, if you want anything writing beautifully, just go to Zita. She'll find the time when she's not reading to do it for you. And she wrote this beautifully lettered statement. It says, if God can do it, I can do it. Good? But he's got to be in my position when he does it. Otherwise, it's not fair play.